We're talking on these Wednesday nights about the matter of personal work. And I want us tonight to spend time talking about how do you start a conversation about the Bible. Now, there are all different kinds of approach. Sometimes we hear of those who use the direct approach. Somebody told me a story recently about a brother who was out knocking on doors. He used what you call the direct approach. He said he'd knock on the door and he'd say, "Are you a religious person?" And if they said yes, he said, "What church?" And they would tell me, he said, "Now you want to stay in that church or you want to go to hell? Or do you want to go to heaven?" That is the way to end a religious conversation. And sometimes we have that attitude ourselves. If I just have a religious discussion, and if I can just shut the other person up, if I can just say something that will shut that person down, Jehovah's Witness knocks on your door, and you know that they're there, and they may not be honest. You don't have that right to make that judgment. You don't know what their heart is really like. But if you'll stop and you think about that person in relationship to that, it's not to shut them down. Their soul's out there. But let me begin with this kind of introduction. There is a tendency in our minds to say, well, here's the way I do the best kind of personal work I can do is I just want to live the right kind of life before them, and my life will convert them. You see, there's easy for us. If I'll just be in amongst my family and those that are around me, if I will be that kind of individual that just sets the right example before them, and I'm not diminishing at all the setting the right kind of example. But a Muslim could do that same thing, could they not? You take any person in denominationalism, and if the godliness, and you may have to put that word in quotation mark, but if we think the godliness that we live before them will bring about their salvation, we're not thinking clearly. And what I'm saying all that to say that you will never cause that person to change their lives until sometimes you start a conversation. I think it's rather remarkable. I want you to think about this. It may be that those that are around us, and we think, well, they might be surprised if I talk to them about the Bible. They may be more surprised that you never have talked to them about the Bible. Just let that soak in for a while. They've seen your life and seen your devotion, and the very fact you're here at a midweek service on a Wednesday night, you go to church, you know, three times as much as they do, or maybe 10 times as much as they do, depending on how religious they are. And it may be that they're saying, "I wonder why he or she has never said anything to me about the Bible." And then our fear is, well, if I say something, I'll say the wrong something. I didn't have time to Google this, and some of you have got your smartphones may want to Google this and find out how many times Thomas Edison, who invented the light bulb, how many times he put the wrong filament in there to make the light bulb burn. And somebody said, "You've wasted your time." And I thought the number was 1,000. When I started to put it down in my notes, I said, "That cannot be right." So in my notes, I just wrote down many times, and I'm convinced it was 100 that I read. The number I read was 100. He used 100 different things for that filament in the. And he said, "No." Said, "I learned 100 things that would not work before I've worked out the thing that would work." And so it may be that our fear of I might say the wrong thing is not really fully understood. It might be a good way of us learning how not to do it. Now, it's not all up to us to pick the words. People are not going to be overly impressed by the fact that you use the right words. It's the fervor and the conviction of your heart they want to hear. If your house were on fire, would you want a third grade dropout or somebody with a PhD to come into your house and tell you the house was on fire? My answer is yes, but not one more than the other. If my house is on fire, I don't have to know that the person who's telling me my house is on fire has majored in English and they can speak like the Queen. Doesn't have to be that way. And so sometimes we shelter ourselves by saying, I want to figure out exactly what I ought to say. And if we stay at that point, they won't be converted. And that's the reality. And remember this, the Lord sent me not to, you know that verse. The Great Commission does not say, go into all the world and baptize every creature. And Josh, the thing that you really helped me see is that there's wayside soil, and that kind of soil needs the gospel as much as the most fertile field there is. The kingdom of heaven is like a man sowing seed. And the expectation in our hearts should be that there will be far more rejections than there will be acceptance. And so if that's true, if I said, well, I tried to do this or I tried to do that and I haven't had any success. Oh, yes, you've had success every time. Success is not setting up the study. Now, that's our mind. I'm not successful as a personal worker unless I can set up the study and ultimately lead to the conversion of that person. Was it here or was it at Polishing the Pulpit or some other place that I've been recently that said, imagine Noah preaching 100 years. David, this may be something that you said. Imagine Noah preaching 100 years and you get to the end of 100 years, how many folks has he converted? Well, his family, and that's it. And yet, if we'll stop and look at that, was Noah a successful preacher of righteousness? Yeah. You think he didn't give everybody around him a chance to know the truth? Well, the answer is yes. The Lord sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel. But sometimes we have trouble in bringing up the matter of religion to people. Brother Gus Nichols said, I try to see a sermon in everything. And whenever Dave and I were working on talking about all of this, I thought about what Brother Nichols said. And I thought about how often Jesus in his life made spiritual points about everything. Get your Bibles out. Look in Matthew chapter 4. And I didn't go through all of Matthew. I think I could have gone through all of Matthew. I went about halfway through the book of Matthew. How did Jesus go about bringing up religious topics? Well, look at Matthew the early part of chapter 4. I'm not sure exactly how, if you're eating a loaf of bread or just eating one slice of bread, or you're talking to somebody about dieting. And have you ever thought about, you might bring up about religious conversation? About what you eat? Did Jesus say it's not that is taken into the body that defiles a man, but that which comes out of the heart? But in this, I thought about Jesus talking about bread. Man does not live by bread alone. I don't know if that'd be a religious conversation starter, but if you're ever with someone could you use that as a starting place? Have you heard about this diet and you only eat eggs? Anybody remember that diet? 21 eggs a week. Was it 22 eggs or 21 eggs a week? Anybody remember that? It didn't last very long, you know. I mean, you know, after about, 3 eggs a day for a week, you can't fry eggs and boil eggs and poach eggs, and it's still eggs, you know. But there might be a possibility when you're just sitting around talking to somebody and say, I've been thinking about that. Have you ever thought about what Jesus said about man shall not live by bread alone? I don't know if that's a conversation starter or not. But it could be. And that's sort of what I want to talk about tonight is how do you start this conversation instead of just talking about who's kneeling or not kneeling at the national anthem or things of that nature, to try to bridge the gap and head it over into a religious conversation. Look in Matthew chapter 4 and look down look down at verse 19. How did Jesus start a religious conversation? Did I got the right verse?
Talking about fishing.
Yeah. He saw a man with an occupation. And Jesus used that man's occupation to make start a religious conversation. You ever seen anybody using blueprints in construction? You ever seen an instruction manual that is absolutely necessary to make this program work? Is there some way you could not say, have you ever thought of the parallel between following these and you take that person's life and take that what they're doing and use their very occupation to bring them over to talking about following a blueprint is the same as following the blueprint of somebody's life. Have you ever thought about the fact of how much the Bible is like a blueprint? Could you do that? What I'm trying to say is, Brother Nichols said, I try to see a sermon in everything. And we won't have time to look at everything that's in Matthew chapter 4. But is it possible that I'm overlooking the way of just, and I don't mean just constantly always bringing up the Bible, that's not what I'm talking about, but to make the point and to say the point in such a way. Here's a manual. Is there a manual for life? Somewhere down here I've got about the rules of football or baseball or whatever it is. Could you at a sporting event say to an individual about, you know, there isn't it amazing how you can play football anywhere in this world? I think it's rather remarkable that they played American football in England this last Sunday. Could you use that? Could you talk about the fact that you take the rules of football to England and you play the exact same game that's played in America? Is there some spiritual application of that? Brother Joseph, take the rules of American football and take them to England or to India, and you can play American football. That's not a new sport. It's an old sport in a new place. Is there not some way for us to just start looking at the things that are about us? Now, Brother Joseph, you could come and teach us how to play cricket. We would not enjoy playing cricket, but, I saw some cricket in New Zealand, and I don't like a game that lasts for 5 days, and it ends in a tie, and everybody is so excited that the game is tied. I'm sorry, but you see the point we're trying to make? Look in chapter 4, verse 23. what was it that prompted Jesus to be preaching, or what made his preaching effective? Is that 22-23? Is that the verses that said he came preaching, and what was he doing? Am I writing down the wrong verses? Or he was healing people, wasn't he? Is it possible that we could choose a time of sickness as a time and to see in that sickness of that person that you're meeting in the hospital or going out of your way to carry food over to their house? Is there something about that that would make them a whole lot more receptive of anything that you would ever do? You talk about cooking. We talked about football. You want to talk about your grandmother's biscuits? Is it possible that you could say, you know, I found my grandmother's biscuits I wish you could have tasted the biscuits I made last night. And I just got to thinking that if I didn't follow my grandmother's biscuit recipe, what if I followed God's recipe for the church? I want to see a sermon and everything. You look at what Jesus did in relationship to this, and you ever put salt on food or anything? Ever been sitting at a dinner table and there's salt there? Sitting in a restaurant, there's salt there? Did Jesus say anything at all about salt? Is there any way to talk about, have you ever noticed you've got too much salt? Or you ever notice how, and all of a sudden, you're talking about something that is there, and you just take that. Now, how you say that depends on the person you're talking to. And that may not be the type of approach that you would want to use. I mean, it'd be bad to be sitting at a table and there's salt there, and you say, "Well, I'll make you fishers of men." There's just something that's not congruous there in relationship to that. And you and I need to have an appreciation of the fact that Jesus, in his preaching, took ordinary kinds of things. In Matthew chapter 6, the latter part of chapter 6, I put 24 through the end of the chapter, Jesus talked about birds. I know nobody reads the bulletin, but one time this year I wrote a good bulletin article, and I talked about the hurricane. And in one of those lulls, wherever there was the change of, you know, the bands of rain were coming through, I stepped out the front door, and guess what I saw? I saw four birds fly across. Is there a spiritual lesson in that? That's everything Jesus talked about. And so we've got a hurricane, and we say to that person, "Man, I saw something really amazing. And here's what I've thought of." And then you just make the argument, you know, is God as concerned about those birds as he's concerned about me? What we've got to do is to find where that person is. And from that, lead that person to a conversation. Now, I put down several things Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. I talked about the Hollywood style of givers. You know, these people give $1 million to do something and giving out of their abundance and sounding the trumpets ahead of time. And so that's something that's in the news, and you should say, you know what Jesus said about that? You know about the widow's mites? And all of a sudden, all of these things that are around us can immediately be used to turn the conversation to a spiritual use. He saw the birds and the flowers. Remember the lilies of the field? Beautiful flowers. The beauty that God's put in the flowers, or the beauty that God's put in the sunset. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiworks. I saw the most remarkable sunset. You say this at work. I saw the most remarkable sunset I believe I'd ever seen last night. And I just got to thinking, you know, if you can photograph it, it doesn't do it justice. And I stood and I watched it, and every 5 minutes it changed. And it was really, really different every time I saw it. If an artist could do a painting like that, every 5 minutes of a sunset would change, we'd be amazed. What about God's ability to do that? And so Jesus used all of these things. He used the foxes and the birds. Did you talk about the foxes and the birds? The foxes have their den, the birds have their nest. He talked about so many things. He talked about, where's Dirk? He talked about building your house on the right kind of foundation. Dirk, you'll find this interesting. There was when we were building that church building in New Zealand, and we dug down to put the footings in and everything, Brother Merrick, it said, Brother Merrick's father-in-law, I can't remember what the man's name was. He said, you know this rebarb you put in there? They've only got 6 feet of it, and if the fellow's coming out while you're pouring the footings and everything, they just keep pulling that 6 feet down and just pour the concrete, and so when he arrives, all they've got is that 6 foot of concrete without any steel or metal down inside there. Something like that. Building your life on a foundation. Now, think about what Jesus did in reference to the woman at the well. Is it possible that if we could think through what Jesus did, that we might be better soul winners? Here's a woman, immoral, 5 husbands and living with the 6th man. She's come down there to get water. And Jesus said, "Give me water to drink." You know the result of that? The result of that was a religious conversation that had started without ever thinking about that religious conversation being something that needed to be said. What did Paul do in Athens? How did Paul start, at least the sermon that's recorded there, how did Paul start that religious conversation in Athens? "I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I passed by and beheld the objects of your devotion, I saw an altar to an unknown God." Is it possible that you could say to an individual, "Why do you do this?" when you hit a home run? You understand? If you weren't looking, I'll ask it again. Why do you do this when you hit a home run? Does it make a difference if it's left to right or right to left? I don't know if left-handed people do it different the other way or not. What have you done? You started a religious conversation. What about this one? Since Paul talked about the objects of their devotion, what about, "Tell me about your church"? Does that start a religious conversation? And all of a sudden, instead of you ramming the Bible down their throats, they're in the affirmative, at least in the beginning part of it, telling you about, well, why do you do this? What's the reason for this? And ultimately, you're headed to starting a religious conversation. But all you've done is exactly what Paul did. He marched through the city and he said, "There's a sermon right there." That's not a sermon. That's personal work in a public way to the masses that were there. But all that is personal work. Here's one. Tell me about your salvation. Tell me when you were saved. Tell me your salvation story. And don't try to answer them when they're telling their story. You know, Gorman's salvation story was, when I was an infant, I was sprinkled. And my response to that was, after a few minutes, Gorman, are you sure? I don't know if he'd ever even thought about that. And he said, well, I got a baptismal certificate. In fact, the next time I saw him, he brought his baptismal certificate to me. And I said, where'd you get this? He said, my parents gave it to me. I said, did they ever lie to you about anything else? Now, that's knowing Gorman's heart. I wouldn't say that to anybody to any individual. But what about the kind of an approach that I believe is the most powerful thing we have in converting people, and that is the restoration plea of going back and restoring the New Testament church. Last Sunday, we have this couple that come in and clean our house twice a month. They were here at services. I think they'll be back this Sunday. They're from Venezuela. She's more religious than he is. All he'd ever seen was Catholicism. I think he's an atheistic Catholic. I don't know how to describe him, but in the conversation, he's very limited in his, I don't mean very limited, but he's limited in his English and everything. And I just tried in the 5 or 10 minutes I had in the 4 years to say, this really had to be different from anything you've ever seen. Yeah. If all you've ever seen is the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in Venezuela, could I tell you why it's different? You know, there were not always these denominations that are here. And folks, I believe this is the strongest way we possibly can of getting people to see what this church is all about. I said, you know, before there was ever a Martin Luther, there were not any Lutherans. And before there was ever a John Wesley, there were not any Methodists. Well, what did you have before there were ever Jehovah's Witness or, you know, Ellen G. White and the Seventh-day Adventists? What if you just went back before you had any of that? What was there? And you keep going back and back and back and back and say, well, you know, Jesus started a church on this earth. And I used to dread when people say, well, you don't have instrumental music down at your church. I believe it's one of the greatest door openers there is. Can I take just 3 minutes and tell you why? And then you say, Jesus started a church on this earth. And he said, don't ever change it. And when you read the Bible, you read the New Testament about the New Testament church, they never had it. And what we're trying to do in this place is to restore that church. Folks, you don't have to know all the arguments about instrumental music. That's the introductory. It's probably a second step beyond this matter of come and see. Do you not think that folks in the denominational world, do you not think that they're fed up with the reverence. I love telling people, well, now, what's your name? Oh, my name's Dan. That's what my mother called me. And I said, don't call me Reverend Dan. I said, you know why? There's just one reverend, and he's up there. I cannot help but believe the average man in a denominational church that is with a pastor that dominates everything that happens in the church and demands the chief seats in the synagogues and wear special clothing and to be called of men rabbi and rabbi, that the person sitting in the pew doesn't resent the fact that that man is just a man like we are. Well, what if we went back to the way it was back then? And so I talked to that couple of Venezuela, and I said, you know, in the Bible times, you never had to go to some man and confess your sins. And I looked at Carlos, and I said, Carlos, it must really be hard to go and tell some man, and it's none of his business what you've been up to, and to tell him all of the sins of your life. What right does any man or any church have to know about that in your life? I mean, everything he's seen of Christianity has turned him away from Christianity. And his comment, if I understood him, was, I understand things now better than I've ever understood in my life. 5 minutes. How do you start a religious conversation? 3 words. Come and see. There's not a one of us in here, but who can say to others, come and see. And folks, if we are what I think we are at this place, when visitors walk into this building, there's something different about what's happening in this building from what they're usually used to. And there's not any of us that cannot say, come and see. I would beg of you to use the internet. There are folks in this church that use it and use it well. But when David preaches a sermon like he preached last Sunday night, enough is enough. Imagine if 100 of us, imagine if 10 of us, well, let's start with 10. How many friends you got on the internet? You got 200? If you've got 200 friends, I think the limit is it 5,000 or 2,000, whatever that number is of the number of friends. And all you do is you post and say, I heard this sermon. You might want to, it really changed my life. And I know your 200 friends are not interested, and finally they'll defriend you probably. So, but you understand what I'm saying. You take that, and you've given out 200 tracts like that. If you got 200 friends, if 10 members of this congregation did that every week, there'd be 2,000 come and see. Now you got 100 times 200, and that's what. Is that 20,000? 4 zeros would be 20,000. Isn't that remarkable? Come and see. And that's really, really important. Second bell's about to ring, and I've got another announcement I should have made, and that is all who are going to Freed Hardeman needs to meet with Josh down in the high school room, right? I should have made that when the teens were in here in relationship to that. I'm sorry, Josh. I had it in my hands, and some way I didn't make it. If you want to go and tell the teens that might be a good thing right now. I'll excuse you. But you just stop and think about that. When there's something that is special that really means something to you, why do you forward what you forward on Facebook? Because I read it and I thought my friends would be interested in it. Would not your friends be interested? And have you ever sat in an audience and heard a sermon and say, oh, I just wish, and you put that person's name, I wish they could have heard that. Do you know how simple it is to post that and then to say, and it'll be on our website, or just to post the link. If you know how to do that, just copy the link and send the link to them. We're not using the internet. It's a powerful tool, and that's what people are reading. And I don't mean just every day you get up and post something good that's religious. You don't convert people by ramming it down their throats, and don't post that every sermon that David preaches is wonderful and is absolutely perfect, like Tracy thinks they are. I'm joking, Tracy. They are close to being perfect, though, aren't they? David's one of my favorite preachers, too. But if you do it every week, it loses its impact. But if there's something that is special that you've seen, all that is come and see. And then when we have something that's really, really special going on, like this weekend, like Super Sunday, to say, we're having something down at church, I want your friends are probably more surprised that you've not said anything than that you ever said it. I want you to think about that. If they know you and they know your life and know that you're different from what they are, let me make these three points, and then the bell's going to ring probably before I finish this. In religious discussions, do not answer questions prematurely. I used to answer the instrumental music question far different from the way I do now. I believe the answer to you to say that is what would it be like if we just went back and worshiped like they did in Bible times? Don't ever in a religious discussion, I'm talking about at work, well, let me tell you what I think about this. That's what we tend to do. This is what I believe about this. That's not the issue. That's not a Bible study. They know what they believe, and they think what they believe is worth far more than what you think, what you believe. And then I wanted us to take time tonight, do not have time, is to say, if you didn't grow up in the church, what event happened in your life that caused you to be a Christian? In all likelihood, there was that event in your life, or that perchance happenstance meeting of someone, or in some way or other. Somebody said, I've got a treasure. I've got a treasure. I think that's enough for tonight. Thank you very much.